A whole gang of media snoopers, including Jonathan Marks, scans from D.C. to daylight every Thursday here on Radio Netherlands. Their super-duper whopper-doppler receiver gizmos pick out the essence of what's happening in the world of international broadcasting. Radio Netherlands, we have the technology.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By Internet Real Audio G2, the Astra Digital Satellite System, and across the globe through AM, FM, and shortwave outlets. From Hilversum, this is Radio Netherlands. Media Network, the weekly survey of communications developments, produced and presented by Diana Janssen and Jonathan Marks.
Hello and welcome to another 30 minutes of news and features connected with the radio business.
Coming up today, quite a bit of research to share with you, plus investigations as some new transmitters come on the air from several exotic islands around the world. So don't touch those headphones. If you want to have input on our output, you're always welcome to participate. Our address is Media Network, Radio Netherlands, P.O. Box 222, 1200 JG, Hilversum in Holland. That's Media Network, Box 222, 1200 JG, Hilversum in Holland. Or our phone number, open right now, is 31 for Holland, 35-6724-222. That's 31-35-6724-222.
Media Network, with worldwide correspondents who are out to make sense, not dollars.
This past Saturday, August the 19th, a special day was organised in the Netherlands on board the MV Noordernee, the former transmission vessel of Radio Veronica, which is moored in Leeuwarden Harbour in the north of this country. But the reason for the get-together was to honour Radio Caroline. August the 19th means a lot to these fans of offshore radio, for on that date in 1983, a 50-kilowatt signal was switched on using 963 kilohertz, and music and voices from a new radio ship, the Ross Revenge, were heard officially for the first time.
Caroline was back on the air after more than 3 years off the air. For 1980, the vessel which had been the home to the station, the MV Mi Amigo, sank in the Thames estuary.
Although Caroline made a European impact in the 1980s, its contribution in the last 9 years has been more local in nature. After a storm in 1991, the radio ship Ross Revenge had to be towed into Dover Harbour, and the AM transmissions from international waters came to an end. Money had run out, the crew had only one heater left on the bridge, and radio programming was impossible because the equipment had failed. Much of the studio equipment has since been repaired.
Since 1991, the Caroline organisation has had 10 restricted service licences in the UK, during which they've been transmitting for 28-day periods on several locations on the east coast of England, but only with very low power, a whisper compared to their early days. For the past 2 years, they've also hired satellite airtime to broadcast to Europe via the Astra satellite, although only at weekends and with a minimum of publicity.
On August the 19th, though, the Dutch Caroline organisation hired the medium wave transmitter on 1296 kHz, which is owned and operated by Merlin Communications. The BBC still uses this transmitter for some hours in the day, though its operation has been reduced since the start of FM relays of BBC programmes in Eastern Europe. For 13 hours on Saturday, Caroline was heard over much of mainland Europe for a one-day revival, an event that, according to the organisers, generated a lot of positive faxes and emails.
Robert Plant and Big Log here on Caroline. Don't forget, if you're listening on 1296, we'd love to hear your reception reports. Lost the power of speech there. And you can send them to Radio Caroline Support Group, Post Bus 225 8860 AE, Harlingen in Holland. And why not go to their website as well? There's a little thing you can click on there, and a pre-prepared form, and it just you can fill it in. So that would be quite useful for us, actually, just to gauge the reaction and the coverage. So if you point your computer at www.radio-caroline.nl. And it's all quite obvious there. We've had a few phone calls, some just to say hello, some reception reports. So thanks to James Jones, Ian from Southwest London, and Paul Farley. Now, something, irrespective of what people are saying about the reception, they're all saying the same thing, that the music is fantastic. Can't argue with that, can you? This is Garden Party on Caroline.
I went to a garden party to reminisce with my old friends.
At the press conference in Holland, the guy behind this event, Sietse Brouwer from Harlingen, announced that Caroline was also launching a 24-hour programming service over the internet, 9 hours of which will be exclusively programmed for the new medium. Further use of 1296 kHz hasn't been ruled out, but everyone admits that it's unlikely that the huge energy costs, amounting to hundreds of thousands of pounds per year, can be footed by a handful of enthusiasts. Radio Caroline has been dominated by English-language programming, although during the entire history of the station, British investors and advertisers only financed the first 3 years between 1964 and 67. Otherwise, the money has been Dutch, Flemish or American.
And when the ship was towed in Dover Harbour, again the money came from unexpected sources. Several free radio organisations, including the Ross Revenge Support Group, the Foundation for Media Communication from Holland, and also individual listeners, put a lot of money into the organisation with the aim of rebuilding the studio and transmitters and, of course, getting the ship back into the sea. But the last goal never happened.
Hans Knott, who is a well-known writer on offshore affairs, believes there is little chance that Caroline will succeed in realising its goal.
If you heard the broadcast, the correct address for reception reports again is Radio Caroline Support Group, P.O. Box 225... 8860 AD, Harlingen in the Netherlands. And the website www.radio-caroline.nl. Fax number in the UK, 44 for the UK, then 1622 684 485.
Chris Arundel, who works in BBC local radio in the UK, is a regular listener to this programme. He says his station, BBC Radio Humberside, will also be focusing on the offshore broadcasters on Monday, August the 28th.
Between 12 and 13 hours UTC that day, they'll also be speaking to Simon Mason from Hull, who's well known on being an authority on the spy number stations. He's also been a guest on this programme and apparently has a vast collection of music by Dutch bands. He started collecting in the 1970s while listening to Radio Noordzee. Listeners in northeast England and along the Dutch and Belgian coast can hear BBC Radio Humberside on 1485 kHz AM, 1485, maybe also 95.9 MHz FM with this good weather. There's also a website to be found at www.northseagold.cjb.net.
We bring up the line to London now, where our gadget guru, Bob Tomolsky, is waiting to talk to us, but not about gadgets this time, about pirate radio. It seems that while the get-together was going on in Harlingen, land-based operators were also reminiscing. So, Bob, what was it all about?
Well, it was the biggest get-together of land-based pirate stations in something like 35 years. And it was a big booze-up attended by people from Radio Jackie, Radio Free London, Radio Sheila, Radio Invicta, European Music Radio, all the pirate radio stations that have been broadcasting from the UK in the last 30 years made an effort to send people along to this booze-up.
You ain't seen nothing yet. Sweet Louise and on for safe seat before 11 o'clock. It is Jackie to South West London, 01788 4917. If you'd like a dedication next week, 788 4917. We're slowing things down. Bill Withers.
It was very interesting, and I have to say, it was amazing. that so many people have kept an interest in pirate radio over so many years.
Is it something that they've actually put into their own career? In other words, are they now working for legal stations?
Some are working for legal stations. Of course, many of the people involved had a technical interest in pirate radio. They used to build the radio transmitters. And unsurprisingly, all those people are now working for computer support companies, either working in conjunction with the internet or repairing computers or having something to do with electronics rather than broadcasting.
What about the current pirates? Are they very much a different group now?
Yes, it's very much a different thing. The pirates that are on the air now are mainly interested in promoting maybe raves or gigs or events of that sort, and it's not done just as a hobby. The pirates of the old days, pirate radio in Britain, was all about hobby pirates. In other words, people were on the air because they enjoyed broadcasting or because they wanted to put a show out to people, and there wasn't a commercial element. And I have to say, there is also a change in quality. In the old days, pirates used to pride themselves in their audio quality on FM or indeed on the stability of their transmitters or whatever. That's not the case now, and the DTI are often bringing up cases of how pirate radio stations are interfering with emergency services, which sadly seems to be the case nowadays.
You mentioned the Department of Trade and Industry there, DTI. I remember in the early days, of course, it was very much the post office, and Mr. Eric Gotts, who was the bad boy in London, as it were, the person who was going out chasing the pirate stations.
That's right. Eric Gotts has now retired, but that didn't stop a lot of people turning up at the pub the other night with pictures of Eric Gotts and Jim Crow and all the other people who used to play the cat-and-mouse game in the fields and in the forests in South London and around. And I say there were lots of people there talking about how they nearly got caught and how they got caught and what they said at their different court cases. And it was quite fun to hear all these reminiscences.
But are all the pirates of that era long since gone?
No, not at all. There is one pirate radio station that stays on the air on medium wave in London called Radio Free London. They're operating on 819 kilohertz, and they've been on the air, you know, every weekend for as long as I can remember. And I said to them, you know, how is it that they never get raided? Well, they say they keep a low profile, they don't take advertising, they don't have anything to do with drugs. They said that recently they were contacted by a TV station to do a documentary, and they rejected that idea. They don't want too much public exposure. They play the same sort of music that they did 30 years ago. They've been operating for around 30 years, on and off, and they bring back, if you like, that nostalgic air. And many of the people who listen to that station are forming an email group on the internet to stay in contact and to carry information about the old days of medium wave pirate radio.
Radio stations that don't want to broadcast their existence. Amazing stuff. We were talking there to Bob Tomalski.
It's turning out to be an interesting period for those who monitor the goings-on at the BBC. The new Director General, Greg Dyke, has been implementing many new plans, taking the organisation in a very different direction than his predecessor, John Bird. It appears the corporation is seriously rethinking its strategy on digital radio, prompted by remarks in June by BBC Chairman Christopher Bland that they had put too much money into DAB much too soon. The launch of two digital channels for comedy and archives has been put on hold and current budgets are frozen. Digital radio is also being combined with the BBC's radio online activities. So in effect, internet development will include DAB and not the other way round.
Well, DAB has also received another public blow because of an article in the UK consumer organisations magazine Which? The authors tested DAB car radios and home tuners, putting all this alongside digital radio via the Sky Satellite digital package. Their conclusion was that the DAB system offered no significant audio quality advantages and that the car radios were much too difficult to tune. Their advice was to wait until the price of receivers drop, which puts the ball very much into the manufacturer's court. Prices are dropping, but the real take-off is only expected when sets cost around £200. And as we've heard on this programme from Robert's Radio in the past, that is several years away.
In a lecture at the Edinburgh Television Festival tomorrow, Friday, Greg Dyke is expected to attack the Byrd era at the BBC in no uncertain terms, saying that top-heavy management and the self-importance of the BBC must be done away with.
Now, since it's summer, let's put on a gramophone record and relax. We currently have temperatures in Holland to match that sleepy lagoon feeling of a desert island. But thanks to some rather good conditions on shortwave just recently, islands seem to be catching enthusiasts' attention. Brian Clark in Auckland is our next guest as we turn to the reappearance of the American Forces Radio and Television Service on shortwave. We've mentioned that transmitters in Italy, run by the US Navy, have suddenly come on the air, joining existing transmitters in Puerto Rico and Florida. FRTS is back because the armed forces cut back on its use of Inmarsat. And Brian, you've been hearing other sites.
Jonathan, thanks to Andy Sennett, who discovered a list of frequencies for the American Forces Network relaying National Public Radio on shortwave, we now have frequencies and sites for quite a number of AFRTS broadcasts. The most exciting of these is Diego Garcia, which is a small isolated island in the Indian Ocean. I believe the United States and British have military bases there. There's a certain fascination amongst DXs for small islands, and I think Diego Garcia is very much in the mould of the Falklands and St. Helena. It's over 30 years since reception of broadcasts from Diego Garcia has been possible here in New Zealand. Back in the late 1970s, the American Forces Radio and Television Service at Diego Garcia was using a 250-watt transmitter on 1485 kilohertz.
Garcia, B-I-O-D. This is Coconut Radio, 1485 News. The news as it happens, as compiled by the major network wire services and the Navy Broadcasting Service, Detachment 3.
They're actually still listed on that frequency, but it would be impossible today. But back in the 70s, I know of DXs in New Zealand, Australia and South Africa who have prized QSLs from that exotic island. Well, earlier this week, I was very excited to hear the American Forces Network on 4319 kilohertz upper sideband between 1840 and 1940 UTC. And according to the National Public Radio listing, this frequency does come from Diego Garcia.
And apparently Diego Garcia isn't the only one that's been activated.
Yes, since Tuesday the 22nd of August, a transmitter site, reportedly Guam, has been activated. This frequency, 13362 kilohertz, upper sideband, and that's being heard strongly here between 0600 tune-in running past 0800 UTC. But, Jonathan, I'm not altogether certain that this listing is completely accurate. The list records that Iceland is being used for frequencies of 6350 kilohertz and 10320 kilohertz. Now, both of these frequencies are being heard strongly in the South Pacific in the last week and a half. At times when shortwave propagation from Iceland would be quite unlikely, and my suspicion is that these two frequencies are possibly originating in the western North America.
Well, in fact, you're quite close. Those frequencies you're hearing are coming from Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. And since there's so much interest, let's quickly run through the sites for AFRTS. All frequencies are using upper sideband.
Key West in Florida operates round the clock on 12689.5 kilohertz, whilst the site in Puerto Rico is on 24 hours a day using 6458.5 kilohertz.
The US base in Sigonella, Sicily in Italy uses 4993 kilohertz, or alternatively 10940 kilohertz. Guam is operating on 13362 during the day and 5765 kilohertz in the hours of darkness.
Diego Garcia also has two channels, 12579 and 4319 kilohertz. The base at Keflavik in Iceland using 10320 620 and 6350 kilohertz.
And Pearl Harbor uses the same channels as Iceland, but at opposite times to avoid interference. 6350 and 10320 kilohertz upper sideband are the frequencies.
Andy Sennett also has some points to add regarding Diego Garcia.
Yes, if you go to the radio show page at www.medianetwork.nl, there's a link there to an article we published last month giving some of the background history to the US forces on Diego Garcia, and it's not something that you'll find on any of the official US sites. It's quite an interesting story. And if you missed the frequencies Jonathan just mentioned, then click on Media News Desk on our website.
Talking of media news, it looks as though there have been some developments in the Balkans.
Indeed, Radio Yugoslavia, the foreign service of the Milosevic regime, went silent on Sunday after an official from the Republika Srpska in Bosnia handed over an ultimatum to the staff at Radio Yugoslavia's shortwave centre at Bjelnina. The ultimatum gave them 48 hours to suspend broadcasting and leave the transmitting centre, which is on Bosnian territory. Now, a statement on Radio Yugoslavia's website says its staff at Bjelnina had been threatened several times, and the statement adds, "We will find ways to broadcast the truth to the world," quote. At the moment, though, web links to its online news service have also been deactivated, so it appears that no broadcasts are currently being prepared. There were also shortwave transmitters at Stublina in Serbia prior to the NATO air attacks last spring, but it appears that this site was destroyed, so we wait to see what will happen next.
Radio Netherlands Consumer Investigation. We dig deeper.
About 20 years ago, there was quite a sensation in electronics magazines in Europe when an integrated circuit called a ZN414 came onto the market. It's still around, and yesterday we found listings on the internet indicating its market value is around $10. This device is basically a medium wave radio on a single chip containing some 10 transistors. If you add a penlight battery, a tuning coil, capacitor, an antenna and an earphone, you've got a miniature portable radio, which will operate on medium wave, even on the 41 and 49 meter band shortwave if you build it in the right way. There are links to construction projects using this IC on our website for those who want to dust off the soldering iron.
But as you may have gathered, the ZN414 managed to put a lot of components onto a small pinhead, but it won't work without some relatively large add-ons, like the tuning coil, for instance. There's growing commercial pressure, especially in the mobile phone industry, to even go further with the integration job.
Patrick McBride from Glasgow in Scotland listens to us on 1512 kHz medium wave in the evenings, using a radio he made himself, and asks us to find out what's happening next in terms of miniature radio technology.
Our colleagues on the Radio Netherlands Research File programme have just paid a visit to a scientific group in the Netherlands who are trying to tackle this problem. They put us on to Professor Bram Nauta, and he works at the Department of Integrated Circuits at the University of Twente in Enschede, and that's in the eastern part of the Netherlands.
Radio exists already for many years. People have AM, FM radio since the beginning of the century already. Radios were quite bulky, and later came the portable radio, the transistor radio, and so on, Walkman, and so on. On the other hand, there was chips, microchips, invented 40 years ago, microprocessor, early 70s, up till the Pentium today, and this will go on for many years. So there's a lot of computing power in a small piece of silicon, that's a microchip. And since the early 90s, the speed of the chips was fast enough to process analog radio signals directly from an antenna. So from that time on, you could make parts of a radio, the high frequency parts, so where the signals are changing very, very fast. You could do that signal processing on a chip.
In the commercial world, there's not much of a market for an even smaller analog radio. If the device was smaller than the size of a button, how would you tune it? And the lead to the headphones would probably snap off anyway. But in the high-tech, high-risk world of mobile phones, the higher the level of integration, the lighter the device, and the lower the battery consumption. But what's the problem when it comes to selectivity?
The main components of a radio are transistors to make amplification of weak signals and the so-called passive components, which are inductors and capacitors. They make selectivity, so they filter one radio station or one transmitting station, one telephone, from the whole jungle of radio signals. Well, the transistor on the chip, that's no problem. the capacitor is not a problem, but the inductor, that's not such a good component. You have to make a spiral shape. So if you look on top of it, it's a flat two-dimensional spiral. And, well, that works as an inductor, but the problem is on the chip, the quality of that inductor is not so good. So it doesn't really behave like a good inductor. And that means that the selectivity is not so good. So besides one received channel, you receive more other channels. And also the noise of the receiver becomes higher. So you can circumvent that by burning a lot of power in the transistors to lower the noise. But then your batteries are drained. So that's why that's not really used at this moment. So the inductors are still outside. And, well, what we try to do is to play with new architectures of radio circuits to circumvent those inductors, or at least live with bad inductors.
The solutions to this inefficiency problem can be found at all levels of circuit design, from the total concept right down to the micro level. The challenge comes because the physics of the devices obeys different laws at these submicron levels.
So we're trying to find other compromises. If you have bad inductors, that means you get a lot of noise. And noise is a big problem, it's one of the challenges. And if there's too much noise in a radio, the signals are not strong enough to come over the noise, so you don't see them anymore between the noise. So this, in fact, if you try to talk together in a big place where much more people are shouting, you cannot hear each other, so the shouting people are the noise. So you have to get rid of the noise. Well, normally you can lower the noise by taking a lot of current from your batteries through the electronic circuits, but then the batteries are drained. So that's the problem. What we found out, that if we switch off transistors very quickly, then a certain important part of the noise is removed. And that's very interesting, because that's new, and we are in fact the only group in the world who looks at that right now, that you, by switching them off, you save power, and also the noise is less. And that's the opposite what the traditional school says. When you want to have lower noise, you must burn more power, get more current from your battery. We do the opposite and also achieve less noise. Well, this is in a very preliminary stage, so we are doing the first experiments and so on, but it looks quite promising.
Turn it off if you want to. Switch it off, it'll go away. Turn it off if you want to. Switch it off.
So let's return to the cocktail party analogy.
Yes, in fact, you can compare it when you're in a big reception and a lot of people are shouting around, that somebody next to you is talking too loud, so you cannot understand the one you're listening to. That every 10 seconds you bang him on the head. And then he needs a few seconds to recover. And in that time, you can talk to your person. And if you do it quick enough, then you have a silent person next to you. That's in fact what we do with a transistor. It depends on the type of transistor, but a factor 10 can be achieved.
So reduction in battery consumption by a factor of 10. But what sort of applications are these Dutch scientists planning for such tiny transceivers?
Yeah, in fact, if you make a radio on a chip or a telephone on a chip, then you can make a telephone for in-house use, for example, as big as a sugar cube, or because then you also need a small battery and so on, so that you don't have so much transmit power, so you cannot transmit if you're outside on the beach, that it's too far away. But for short range, well, sugar cube-sized radios, or maybe smaller, are feasible then. Well, you can think of many strange things, because now radios are used to communicate between people. But, well, this morning I was thinking of a big restaurant where a lot of cups and glasses are standing everywhere, and suppose every glass has got a radio inside, and the waiter can see from his terminal where are the dirty glasses, so he can pick them up, or which glasses are almost empty, so he can check a new order. So, in fact, those kind of strange things can be realized with very compact radios.
Very interesting. But Professor Bram Nauta at the University of Twente in Enschede does admit that these type of devices are at least 5 to 10 years away. Thanks to Lisbeth de Bakker of our sister program Research File for making the interview. Lisbeth wrote a more in-depth article on her visit to Twente, and there's more information posted now on the Media Network website. Check it out.
And that's your lot for now. We're back on the 31st with more from the media. In the meantime, Diana and I both wish you
a sunny weekend.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives. from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.